Good afternoon. My name is Linda, and I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. I want to thank you. I want to thank the readers. I was so touched, and I would enjoy sitting beside you in a meeting anytime. Thank you so much. And Nancy, thank you. You're just a new friend that I just met yesterday. It's so great to hang out with you. I'm going to apologize for my voice. I truly got laryngitis 30 minutes after I finished speaking in Houston, Texas last Saturday. I mean, it turned into a whisper. And I whispered to my husband, "It's every AA's dream, an Al-Anon that loses her voice." And I went back to Nashville and I told my sponsor, and she says, "Maybe God wants you to listen instead of talk so much." So with all that help and the help of some of my doctor and some pretty strong medication, and plus I've been drinking iced tea, caffeine, and I haven't been able to talk for a week, so hang on, I have no idea what this is going to look like. You know, as they're reading the steps and then the traditions, when it's about my turn to speak, I sometimes wish they would read the concepts and maybe even the warranties also, you know, to just kind of drag it out for as long as we could before I have to get up here. Because I get anxious. I have a great sense of love for Al-Anon. It's something that literally saved my life and changed my life and is very much a part of my life. I've been in Al-Anon a little over 18 years, and I absolutely embrace it on a daily basis. And I feel very honored to come here and speak. What a gorgeous place that we are. But I have anxiety. I think it's because of my love for Al-Anon. But you've taught me to ask for what I need. So I'm going to ask for a moment of silence. In some areas where they say the Serenity Prayer before the meetings, they have a moment of silent prayer. And somebody one time asked our co-founder, Lois Wilson, the co-founder of Al-Anon. She was married to Bill, the co-founder of AA. Somebody asked her what she did in the moment of silence. And she said, "I invite God to the meeting." So if you'd be willing to ask the God of your understanding to come and be here with us, and that'll give me a chance to breathe. I've already said my prayers, but I just need that little extra prayer. So some silence, please. Thank you so much. And, you know, now I'm not up here by myself. I've got the God of my understanding. I know I've got the support of my sponsor because she cheers for me. And I think that's a characteristic of a sponsor or a good sponsor. She cheers for me. I can call her and she cheers for me. I don't know how to say it any other way. I've got the support of my home group. They gave me this little safety pin because that's how we help one another in our group. It was kind of our low-budget guardian angel. When somebody's going to go off and do something scary, we give them an everyday household safety pin. Everybody in my home group held it, and they said it's for when you're going to go do something scary, like give a talk or visit parents, you know. So I've got my group up here. And I also have the support of this committee. What a fantastic committee you have here. They were so supportive when we called and told them about my laryngitis. You've been so supportive. If I had to put one word about this committee and this conference together, it would be the word happy. And this seems like a happy place to be and happy recovery. I just feel very honored. Florence, thank you so much. Conferences don't just happen. And my observation is the better and the more fun the committee has, the more fun the conference is. And your third annual, looks like at the Low Country, looks like you're having a great, great time. I got rather tickled, though, because when Scott and I got here yesterday, they put us in a lovely room. Actually, it was room 134. When we got our program, it was also the hospitality room. I thought, this is a new commitment for speakers. This is this is going to get a bit interesting. But don't we love the party? You know, we may have given up the drink, but we're not going to give up the party. We are social animals. We like hanging out together. And that's why we have these conferences, and that's why they're planning that big birthday party July 4th up in Toronto. I don't know about you, but I'm saving my nickels and dimes and pennies, and I'm heading that way because the internationals are so much fun. You get 60,000 people saying the Serenity Prayer. Your toes feel it. Your heart feels it. Now, I've been in Al-Anon long enough. I could have gone to Seattle, but that just didn't work out. So my first international was the one out in San Diego. And Scott and I were married, and we showed up at the airport in Nashville, Tennessee. And, you know, not too surprising, we ran into some people we knew from meetings, and they were getting ready to go to that big celebration out in San Diego also. And I think that I like to tell this story because it kind of sets it up of the attitudes about our having a good time. I think that plane left Nashville and stopped in St. Louis. And some of the earthlings, the regular people, got off, you know, but some more of us got on. And because you could tell because of the jewelry with the circles and the triangles on it. So it was a huge, huge jet flying all the way out to the West Coast. And it was absolutely a big, big airplane. And I'm on a holiday, so I'm having a great time. And I'm at the back of the plane waiting my turn to get into the ladies' room. And I start chatting with the flight attendant because she's working. And I mean, she was working hard. I could tell. And I said, well, are you okay? How's it going for you? Are you having a good day? And she says, well, yes. She said, I am having a good day. She said, we're very busy. She said, every single seat is taken. And we have never served so much coffee. Yeah, that's us, you know. And we got out there and at the international, and kind of what I encourage us to hear, you know, sometimes the conferences are great and these speaker meetings are great, but sometimes that meeting out there walking on the beach, isn't that sometimes the best meeting? So they encouraged us in San Diego to wear our badges everywhere we went, and the conference hadn't started, but we'd picked them up, and Scott and I were going to go out to SeaWorld, and as we got out of our taxi, there were two Japanese men and a Japanese woman that they had badges on, and they were trying to get into the taxi. And we all noticed our badges, and we stood there on the sidewalk. Now, they had absolutely no English, and we had no Japanese. But we stood there, and we bobbed, and we hugged, and we pointed, and we cried. And we spoke the language of the heart. There, it was an incredible exchange. So I support committees and anybody that comes together to put a conference on. I support you for participating in your recovery this afternoon on a Saturday afternoon. I mean, this is a grand thing. You want to know who the winners are? Look at the person right beside you because you're participating in your own recovery. So out in San Diego, I was invited to be on one of the Al-Anon panels. Not like tell my story, but like months ahead of time, they gave me an assigned topic, and I could use our Al-Anon conference-approved literature and my experience, strength, and hope, and kind of share for about 15 minutes around the topic. And my topic that came was, I chuckled, it was living with sobriety after the honeymoon's over. Since I'm in my third marriage, I thought maybe they wanted a honeymoon planner, you know. I honestly can't tell you too much about what I said that day because the woman that talked before me, in her introduction of herself, she told my entire Al-Anon story just in the way she said hello. Fantastic woman. I've visited with her often. And this is what she did. She said, hello. My name is so-and-so, and I'm from Georgia. I'm a member of Al-Anon, and I'm addicted to mood-altering men. I go, oh, that's why I've been having to go to all those meetings, you know. I do. I just have this wonderful gift that I get, or antennae, that just goes right there to that creative, that living on the edge personality. Scott and I get to go across the country and do this quite often. Most of the time it's to an AA function. Most of the time he's only talked to the AA member on the telephone, so somebody's going to greet us at the airport that we've never laid eyes on. We've worked out this great plan. Scott says, I'll go get the luggage and you go pick them out. Because I can. I just have this talent. In fact, Scott is so supportive of this gift, this talent that I have. He's so supportive of recovery in our hometown of Nashville, Tennessee, that he came up with this great plan. And for my birthday several years ago, he had about 300 business cards printed up for me. And he says, you know, this will really help our community here. He says, if you're at the grocery store and you look over there and you see somebody that you're attracted to, he said, you can hand them one of these business cards. The front of it has my name, phone number, a couple of butterflies, you know, very appropriate. The back of it says this: Hi, my name is Linda. I am a member of Al-Anon. I find you attractive, so I suggest you go to the nearest treatment center and have an assessment done. Just to help, yeah, just to help with that. And I can lovingly tell you that the first man that just took my heart away that probably could use an assessment is my dad, you know. I've known my dad all my life. I've seen my dad drink almost every day of my life. I've seen my dad drunk a lot of days of my life. And I want to tell you, I had an incredibly wonderful childhood. I grew up in West Texas, Odessa. And it was a wholesome time. We had sidewalks, and we played outside, and we looked at the stars at night. And I traveled with my parents. I was an only child, so they gave me a lot of stuff. All the money that needed to be divided between other brothers and sisters, I got it all. I had nice clothes. I had nice shoes. I had my own room. They gave me a spiffy car, a little sports car convertible when I was in high school. So my parents gave me a lot. But something strange was going on in that household, and I couldn't have told you what it was. I couldn't have told you how to do with my dad's drinking because it looked like such a fun time going on, and it was such a daily way of life. I couldn't have said, eating macaroni and cheese is really wrecking this family, any more than I could have said, my dad's drinking. Now, my dad is in his early 80s, and he shared with me that he's going to do three things for the rest of his life, and he named them like sporting events. He said, I'm going to fish, I'm going to play golf, and I'm going to drink. And thanks to Al-Anon, I can say, I love you, Dad. He's one of the most incredible men you'd ever want to hang out with. He's just an incredible man. I never heard my parents argue about anything other than my dad's drinking. And my mother was one of the women that would wait. You know, we'll wait for supper. We'll wait to ask your dad if you can go to the prom. We'll wait, and we'll wait till your dad comes home. So things were happening in that household that I didn't know was affecting me. Until I got into Al-Anon as an adult, and I got my hands on some of the Alateen literature. And I don't care which program you're in, you take this little pop quiz, the little 20 questions of, is Alateen for you? And maybe you'll realize that we're sometimes not the first flowers to bloom in the garden, that some things were going on in a household that would have allowed us to qualify for Alateen. Like, did you stay out of the house as much as possible? I did. I'd be at school, and I'd be wondering what was going on at home. Or I'd be at home, and I'd be thinking of a way I could get out of there. Were holidays frequently interrupted? Did you think that nobody loved you? Just take this little quiz and read the Alateen literature. It has got simple language that goes straight to the heart, and it's got recovery in it. And it makes you understand that maybe why you didn't do so well on that math test is in the seventh grade is because your mind was someplace else. I really recommend it. So that time that I was living in that household with my parents, who gave me a lot of love and gave me a lot of stuff, and they still continue to love me and give me a lot of stuff, I still begin to get that hollowness inside, that empty space, that vast abyss that I didn't know what to fill it up with. I think now that I was started working on what I've now come to call step zero, I had a big nothing in my stomach, and I was looking for something. So I chose to stay home and go to college and still live with my parents because I still kind of had to keep an eye on the situation, even though I thought I needed to get out of it. And I'm on this college campus, and I look over, and I see this young man, and I could have given him one of these business cards. My heart went pitter-patter, and something must have pitter-pattered in him because in 2 weeks he asked me to marry him. And we went in and announced to my parents that we were going to get married, and they started asking difficult questions like, don't you think he should have a job first, you know? And we're going, that's just details. We'll work it out because, you see, we were very, very much in love. I graduated from high school in 1964, for those of you that need some dates to work with. I married this young man in 1965, and quite honestly, back then, I'd been a good girl for about as long as I could be. And so I married this young man, and my parents gave us a perfect wedding. The gown, white gown, coming down the center aisle, and we lived happily ever after for the first week. And then to celebrate our marriage of 1 week, my then husband brought home two of his best friends. Now, we were still college students, and Cliff, I think, was probably in my husband's history class. And they came in carrying their other best friend, and that was Bud in the cooler. So that night I saw Cliff, my husband, and Bud have a party to celebrate our one-week anniversary. And I saw Cliff, our friend, kind of pass out or maybe go to sleep on our couch. And I saw my husband kind of pass out or go to sleep on our bed. And we lived in a very small apartment. In fact, it could fit in this room. It could fit in half of this room. And I took the pre-Al-Anon stance, hands on my hip, looking around at these guys like they're a bunch of fallen trees. And I had a conscious thought, I am not going to let him get away with this. He's not going to get drunk to celebrate our being married for 1 week. I'd never seen him drink before. And I thought, he's not going to get away with this. So that night, I was always one of these pre-Al-Anons that I would come up with a plan or a script or control, whatever title you want to call it. But I just knew if I did what I was supposed to do, then and I could make you do what you were supposed to do. So that night, to show my husband he could not get away with getting drunk on our one-week anniversary, to show him I slept in the bathtub. It seemed like a great plan at the time. And, you know, the next morning, he's got this horrible hangover. I've got this horrible backache. And it was kind of a hangover and a backache that lasted for 16 years. And two wonderful daughters, you know. We just started doing the dance. Now, this young man had a little trouble finding himself. He just really couldn't get settled down. And that kind of meant I couldn't get settled down because he couldn't get settled down. But we'd been married about 3 years when our first daughter was born. And for some reason, I thought when they sent you home from the hospital with this baby, you also got little unwritten instructions that said, here are the diapers. Here's how you take care of the baby, giving him a bath. And now you're going to be adults. You know, I thought parent equaled meaning being an adult. So now we're going to live happily ever after. But in truth, it didn't get better. In fact, it got more desperate because there were more bills and more uncertainty about what was going to happen. So accidentally, and truly accidentally, my husband got a job. I mean, he went to a local club, like at a Holiday Inn. It was a Holiday Inn. And he went and auditioned for the lounge act. He was a very good singer, and he could play the guitar. And at that point in time, every Ramada, every Holiday Inn had a lounge. It was a private club. You had to pay a dollar to become a member, and they all had entertainment. And now he started making more money than we had seen in 1 week, that we'd seen like in 6 months. I mean, he now has a job. And that Holiday Inn asked him to go to another Holiday Inn 30 miles away. And that Holiday Inn asked him to go to another Holiday Inn 120 miles away. And I've got this young baby, and he's out there singing. And I thought, well, I can't let him go off without adult supervision. So I packed up all the diapers, and I packed up the hot plate, and I started being the camp follower. And I followed this man around from Holiday Inn to Ramada all over Texas. At this point in time, we didn't even have a permanent address. We didn't have any place to pick up mail because we were the Rolling Stone. We were just going on down the road. And when I first got into Al-Anon, I look back at that year, that 16 years of marriage, the times that we did not have an address. We also moved 13 times in 16 years with an address. We call those geographic cures. You gave me a name for that. And when this young man would stand in front of me and he'd say, let's go to Houston, I'd say, okay. And it's not that he ever was trying to set me up. He really believed it too. I think we desperately try to outrun this disease. And we pack up the dishes and the books and the disease, and we move on down the road. And, you know, 13 moves in 16 years, that sounds like a lot. I think if you go over there in that archives room and really do some research that Lois and Bill Wilson had 52 different mailing addresses. We desperately try to outrun this disease. So here we are living in hotels, and my husband's coming home from work every night. Now, he kind of looked like and acted like and smelled like he'd been to a party, but it was work because he's going down to the club every night singing, and he's having a really good time. And I am living upstairs with a toddler by now, and I'm looking at four walls and reruns, and I'm pretty bored. And I don't know anybody, and I come up with a plan. So I announced one Friday afternoon to my husband, I said, I'm going to be the drummer in the band. He said, have you ever played drums before? I said, that's just details. We'll work it out. I took our bass player, who is now a very successful musician in Nashville. But then he was part of our band. I took him to a pawn shop. $50 I plopped down, and I bought a whole trap set of drums. I had a bass drum. I had two ride toms, a floor tom, a hi-hat, a crash cymbal, a snare drum. Monday night, I was the drummer in the band. You cannot tell me we are not determined people. I thought I had to be there to stand by my man. And so I would play drums night after night, night after night, and we would travel around, and we'd get some local high school girl to take care of our daughter upstairs, and now we're doing this fantastic life. We'd come into a town, and our name would be up there on the marquee. We're becoming very, very successful. Other bands like to come and make music with us, the after-hours party. You might remember some of those. That means the law says you can't serve any more alcohol. We lock the door, and we take the party all night long. And many, many, many nights, the babysitter would have to go home because she was a high school kid, and she had to get up early the next day. And I've got this baby upstairs, and I don't want to miss the fun. So I would go upstairs, and I'd take the phone off the hook, and I'd put it by my daughter's head on her pillow. And I'd go downstairs where the party was going on, and the drink is happening, and the music's happening, and I'd take that phone off the hook in the club, and I'd lay it down. And I'd make music all night long. And every now and then I'd take a break. And I'd go over and I'd listen to that phone to see if that baby was awake, that young girl was awake. And I thought I was a really good mom. And now I look back on that and it seemed like such a good plan. But what insanity to leave like a two-year-old up in a hotel room by herself. What if there had been a fire? What if somebody had broken in? What if she did get into her baby aspirin and her cough syrup one time, and I had it up on the clothes rack. She climbed up there and got it one time. I mean, but it seemed so sane at the time. I guess the days before I got into recovery could best be described like interstep. I mean, we were living in insanity, and we were calling it sane. It was unbelievable. So here we are making music and traveling all over, and we had just really had a hard time, but a successful time. And I think that finally this young man comes to me and he says, let's move to Nashville, Tennessee. And I thought, great. What better place for a musician and a songwriter to be? This has to be the end of the moves. So there are 8 years between our girls, and so we moved to Nashville, Tennessee, and our youngest daughter turned a year old. And now we're going to be at the end of it. All this traveling, we are going to live happily ever after. And what happened in Nashville, Tennessee, the music industry is very, very serious. And sometimes what happens with the progression of the disease, taking care of the party becomes more important than taking care of the business. And I saw this man become disillusioned. He did not get, he got some success, but not a lot. It didn't come fast enough. And he came to me one day and he said, get packed. We're leaving. We're going back to Texas. And I have to tell you, I stood there very, very old and very, very worn out and very, very used up. And I only could say, I can't. I cannot pack one more time. And he said, well, I guess we get a divorce. And I said, well, I guess we do. And this man that had fathered my two daughters, the gentleman next door was an attorney, and he brought up a simple divorce. And that husband packed up all of his music instruments, and he took off to Texas, and he's living there happily ever after. He started a new family with a new wife, and just recently circumstances happened that we hung out together for 2 or 3 days. And, you know, it was a gentle time because I was able to thank him for the for these two wonderful daughters he gave me. I was able to thank him for ever getting me to Nashville, Tennessee. It ended up being a wonderful place for me to grow up as an adult, you know, and to get into program. And I keep him in my prayers every day because he's the natural father of my children. Meanwhile, it's my story, and we're the little family left in the rearview mirror as he pulls out of the driveway. And here's the mom, whose resume says drummer in the band. here's the pre-teenage daughter, and here's a little three-year-old. And I'm at a loss. But the same attorney that handled the divorce, he said, there's a gentleman that has a commercial real estate company on the same floor, the 25th floor of the First American Center downtown. That's one of the high rises, very, very prestigious office building. He said, this guy, you go talk to him. He's looking for somebody to, an office manager. And, man, I didn't realize that my character defects of control could be used so skillfully. I go down and I sometimes slip and say, I went down and auditioned for that job because that's what we always used to do in the band. We auditioned. We never interviewed. We auditioned. But I interviewed for that job and I got it. And all of a sudden, I am managing. I am managing this office. I am managing shopping centers. I'm managing my family at home because I taught my daughter to take care of the house and the little girl's going to be the family and I'm out there managing things. And I have to tell you that I took to working the same that anybody would with any drink or drug. I got my broker's license, and I started working in commercial real estate, and I started making a lot of money because now we're going to live happily ever after, my girls and me, because mom's going to bring home in a lot of money. And I have to tell you, I turned the back on my girls the same anybody would being obsessed by a drug or a drink. I would give them messages like, just get yourself off to school. I've got to go for a power breakfast meeting. I've got to network a little bit here. Or I'd call them and I'd say, y'all just stick something in the microwave because mom's got some very important clients in from out of town. Now, what's that message to them? Very important clients. Y'all just get your little life done and I'll be over here taking care of this. So that was the lifestyle that I did for several years, really, really being very successful. And I got a lot of strokes. I was a female in a mostly male-dominated business, and I got great rewards from society saying, go, girl, from my family because I was making a lot of money. You know, it looked so neat, and yet it was a horrible time now that I look back on it. It was a desperate time. So we get the Christmas pictures one year. And I look at them. There's the mom. There's the teenage daughter. There's the little daughter. We don't look happy. What's missing from this picture? A man. I'm now in my mid-30s. I don't think I have a lot of time, so I marry my boss. Now, this man, when I went to work for him, he'd been asking me out, but he was married at the time, and he kept saying, that's just details. We'll work it out. Does this not look like a Cinderella story? Here is a man who marries his secretary who had become very successful. He adopts her two children. He moves us into a mansion, literally a mansion. It had six bathrooms, and it was right across the street from the governor's mansion. And now I know we are going to live happily ever after because we are putting my girls in private school. We are wearing designer clothes. We are driving brand new automobiles. We have about six sailboats. We are traveling all over the world. We're in all of the right clubs, like Friends of the Wine Club and the 100-year-old Cognac Club, and we're the movers and shakers. And it looks like we're having a great, great time. But something very scary was going on in that household. Some unbelievable things were going on behind closed doors. And I say that was the time that we were the looking good, feeling bad family. I mean, we were like a movie set. It looked so great up here, and you walk behind it, and some frightening things were going on. And I would go to my people at my church, and I'd say, I think I'm going crazy, or something's not right with my life. And they would look at my lifestyle and my mailing address, and they'd say, what do you have to complain about? So I'd go away. I'd go into my doctor and I'd say, I am really losing it. Something very, very strange is going on in my life. And he would look at my mailing address and my lifestyle, and he'd say, what do you have to complain about? So I'd go away. Things got really bad, and I didn't think a second failed marriage would look good on my resume, since it was kind of short anyway. So I took that man into, kicking and screaming actually, into marriage counseling. It was a buzzword at the time, and I'd pick this doctor out of the Yellow Pages, and we would go in to this doctor every time we'd have a fight, and I would immediately start weeping and weeping and weeping uncontrollably. And I was a pretty altogether woman, because I was a businesswoman. And my husband, who was would sit there, and after a while he would fold his arms and actually totally shut down. I mean, just go away. And the good doctor on his side of the desk, he would listen and watch for a little while. And then after a while, I think out of boredom, he would pick up a paperclip. And I remember this time and time again. He'd pick up this paperclip, and he would undo it, and he'd get it just right, and it would look like a little helicopter, and he'd kind of twirl it, and, you know. And, you know, and then he'd look at his watch, and he'd say, oh, you're out of time. He'd say to me, he said, you're too sensitive and you're not sensitive enough, and he'd send us away. And we'd do this. We'd meet with him over and over again, and he'd tell me, you're too sensitive and you're not sensitive enough, and we'd go away. And every time we'd have one of these ferocious fights, we'd also make up by having some kind of wonderful little honeymoon. I mean, we'd go to South America, we'd go to Jamaica, we'd go to Canada, we traveled all over. I mean, what an incredible life this looked like. It's always in the telling. This looked like a true fairy tale, living happily ever after. But we were on one of those little, we were going to go on, it was in February, and we were going to go on one of those little honeymoon trips. And my husband and his friend left it was for Valentine's Day. They went on down to Miami a couple of days early, and the girlfriend and I were supposed to come a couple of days later. Now, you figure out why these guys had to go a couple of days early to get ready for our vacation. You can figure that one out. So these guys go on down there, and we fly into the Miami airport, and I had just finished up a really big deal, I was exhausted. I mean, it was a big one of the biggest things that I'd ever been involved with, and it had just closed, and it was a celebration, but I was absolutely exhausted. And so they pick us up at the Miami airport, and we start that day out with road trip. That's road trip with a capital R. You might remember those. And they had the cooler, and they had the fun, and they had the music on. And I'm in the back seat. I'm just exhausted. And we traveled all that day without stopping to eat or anything, just the party on wheels. And finally, the end of that day is probably about 9 o'clock, maybe 10. We finally end up in the lower Florida Keys at a very nice restaurant. I know it was nice because I do remember it had tablecloths. I know it was very nice. And we're sitting there for our holiday, and this other couple is right across from us. And I look around, and I'm going to have this nice meal of seafood. And, oh, we are going to live happily ever after. I just know it. And then I said something wrong. I said, pass the salt, please. Or I said, please pass the salt. But whatever I said, it was wrong. And what I know now is I saw the monster of the disease show up in my husband's face. And I recognized it, and I knew there was going to be a scene for some reason, and it was going to be ugly. And it was going to be loud, and it was going to be public, because we had played that scene before. And something in me snapped. I said, that's it. I'm leaving. I'm going home. And they thought I was going back to the hotel. I went over to the cash register's desk, and I called a taxi. We were in this small town that probably only had about 4 or 5 city blocks, and I called this little cab. And this little cab driver picked me up, and where to, ma'am? And I said, take me to the Miami airport. I'd seen it done in the movies, you know, and this is, you know, many, many miles away. And this little cab driver was trying to explain something to me, but I was so distraught, I couldn't figure it out. And I had traveled a lot, and I'm pretty sophisticated, but to tell you the truth, I'd never been home with the cab driver before, and that's what he was telling me, that he was taking me home with him. And about the time I should be concerned about this, as we pull up in his driveway, his wife opens the door, and she says, hey, honey, come on in here and wait inside. She says, that cab won't make it to Miami. He's got to go get the big van ready to take you, so you come wait inside. So I go up there, and I step into their house which was really almost like one room. Maybe they had a bedroom over here. But I stood there at the threshold of this house, and I stopped because it was a home. I backed up. She was folding clothes there on the couch, and she had some kind of wonderful soup or gumbo cooking back there at the back. The kitchen was just on the back wall of this room. And I thought, this feels so safe. And I'm going back to that coal mansion with six bathrooms, but this feels so safe. And she said, you look kind of rough. Is there anything I can do for you? And I said, well, I would like to buy a pair of those cotton socks that you were, I'm always a business person. I'd like to buy a pair of those cotton socks because I had on a sundress and some sandals, and this was in February, and Nashville had had a pretty good snow for Nashville, and I knew I was going back to that, and I'd walked out without anything. And I said, I'd like to buy a pair of those socks. And she said, honey, I'll just give them to you. So she gave me those socks, and I say she trusted me with her husband because I really was a distraught woman. And I also always like to add, they were very good business people. They made me pay them in cash. I was a distraught woman. I mean, you know, just hysterical. You know, you've heard, I was a hysterical woman, I guess. So, I've got a plan. I'm going to get to the Miami airport. I'm going to get on a plane. I'm going to go back to Nashville, Tennessee. I'm on a run here. And we get back early morning at the airport, and there were no planes going to Nashville. In fact, there were no planes going anywhere. And so I called to get a hotel room. No big deal. I'll stay the night in Miami. But there was a sailboat show going on and some kind of automobile race going on. And there was not a room to be had. Trust me, I could have found a room. I can negotiate a deal. But there was no rooms to be had. So my only option was wait till there was an early flight out to just spend the night there in the airport. Doesn't sound like a big deal. And I don't think it is now, but that particular night in that part of the airport where I was, it was under construction and it was open to the street. And this very sophisticated businesswoman that had a lot of money in the bank spent the night like a bag woman, just trying to stay safe. I mean, it was a rough night, a rough few hours. And I'm moving, trying to keep on where the light, they kept turning the lights off. I guess they were closing that part down, and I just kept moving on a little bit more, and some of these not-so-comfortable people just kept kind of, you know, stalking and moving around, and it was a difficult night. And I ended up with my back against the wall praying. Now, I probably hadn't prayed since the now I lay me down to sleep with my daughters, but with my back up against the wall, I prayed. And the prayer sounded like this: God, my life is unmanageable. That was my prayer. My life is unmanageable. That morning, I get a flight out, and I go to our very nice house. I don't even go to my bedroom because it was not a comfortable place. My oldest daughter is in college, and the young daughter was over with the babysitter. And I go into my small daughter's bedroom, and I climb into her twin bed with all the stuffed animals and all the little pink furniture around, and I did what I'd been taught to do. I waited for him to come home. That's the only thing I knew to do. I waited. And when this man came through the door, he was angry. I was this man's fourth wife, and the first thing he said to me was, "No woman has ever walked out on me before, and you embarrass me in front of my friends. And now there's going to be a scene, and it's going to be awful. It's going to be really severe." But I had that moment of clarity. And remember the doctor, the one that twirled the helicopter? I said to my husband, I said, "Every time we have a fight, we go see the doctor. Why don't we go see him now?" And he stopped, and I'm just trying to buy some time. And because I was very organized, the phone list was there. I call this doctor. You used to have to call weeks and weeks ahead of time to even get an appointment with this doctor. And now I call and I say, "Can we get in to see the doctor?" And the young receptionist says, "Well, yes, somebody just canceled. And if you can be here within 15 minutes, the doctor can see you." Unbelievable. We get in our car and it's only about 10 minutes away. And I want to tell you what that 10 minutes of a lifetime, what it felt like. We know that anger is very, very noisy. I'm talking about a lamp hitting a wall. I'm talking about dishes hitting the floor. I'm talking about skin hitting skin. We know anger is very, very noisy. But the silent anger in that car was absolutely deadly. Silence is so very, very frightening. He is white-knuckling it all the way to that doctor, and I am in my side of the door as far as I can be to get away from him. So we go into this good doctor's office, and I sit there, and my husband sits there, and the doctor goes around on his side of the desk, and he says, "Look, before you start talking," he says, "I need to tell you something." He said, "My name is Dr. So-and-so, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am now in recovery, and I need to make amends to my patients because I haven't always been as present as I should have been." And so from that time to the last time we'd seen this doctor, he was changed. He was now a recovering alcoholic. He was now available. He picked up immediately on what was going on in our household because his household had been living it. And he said, "Look, to make amends to you, my wife and I were going to go to this week-long couples retreat. And so here are the tickets for that, and here's the schedule, and I want you to go up there. These people at this treatment center, they can really help you." So the next day, I am on an airplane going to South Dakota. And my husband and I walk into this treatment facility. An airplane was always one of his favorite saloons, so you can imagine the condition we got there. And I walk into a room not unlike this, and they had the two banners. And just to kind of pass the time, I walked over to read the banners. And, of course, they were the steps and traditions. And there under one was that word unmanageable. And I actually thought, isn't it strange that that word would show up? Because I'm an office manager. I'm a shopping center manager. I manage things. I manage our life. Our cat and dog practically had a daytimer on when they were going to the vet. I mean, I managed. And here we are with that word looking at me again. So we're at this week-long couples retreat, and people are holding hands and walking around the lake, and they're holding hands, going into dinner, and it looked like Noah's Ark. Everybody walking around in twosies. And every time it was our turn to work on our marriage, I would say, "Yay, we're going to work on our marriage." And every time it was our turn, they would take my husband into the other room. And I'm going, how can we work on our relationship if they have him in the other room? And what I know now is that Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, it is not about saving relationships. It's about saving lives. And they had him in that other room trying to knock at some of the denial of some of the addictions. I can share, not only was he an alcoholic, he was also a cocaine addict, and he also had some other hobbies that wouldn't help for an intimate marriage relationship. Not only was he a cocaine addict, he was also a cocaine entrepreneur. That's when you have a very nice address, drug dealer, okay? That translates as drug dealer. So some very interesting things were happening in that household. But now we have recovery, and we've had this week-long exposure to it. And as we're getting ready to leave that South Dakota conference recovery facility, the director of it gave me a big hug as I'm getting ready to get in the shuttle to go back to Nashville, to go to the airport back to Nashville. And he gave me this big hug, and he whispered magic in my ear, and I didn't even know it at the time. He said, "Get yourself to Al-Anon." Now, we're up in the Black Hills of South Dakota. I decided Al-Anon must be an Indian word. I didn't have a clue as to what was going on. So, meanwhile, back in Nashville, Tennessee, we're a family that's been exposed to a little bit of recovery. And what that meant to me was we no longer had the tool of denial to help our everyday living. There were some things that we had to look at, and it wasn't pretty. And weekends were very long at my household. I could hide out at work during the week, but weekends were really, really long. And I'd had a particularly long weekend, and it's Monday about 10 o'clock, and I'm back in my office where I am a president of a company, and I'm sitting at my desk, and I'm falling apart. And I don't fall apart. I can't afford to fall apart. People around me depend on me. We've got to make salaries. We've got to do deals. I do not fall apart. But I remembered the thing about Al-Anon, and I looked it up in the phone book. Thank you for anybody that ever answers at Intergroup or our central office, because you're saving lives truly. I call this, and the number was there. And when I go talk to high school students, I say, if you don't remember anything else I say, you remember that AA and Al-Anon is in the phone book in Hong Kong, in Massachusetts, in L.A. You're going to need it someday in your life. And I'm not so sure that's not our most valuable literature for the newcomers. It's in the phone book. So I call, and how can I ask anything? I don't even know what I'm calling. I don't even know what's going on in my life. And blah, 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 like that. And the lady, evidently, it was a story that sounded familiar, because she said, there's a new meeting. She asked me where I was, and she says, there's a noon meeting that's been going on for about 3 weeks, and it was like three blocks from my office. So she said, I want you to go over there and go to that meeting, and they'll give you some literature, and they'll talk to you, and they'll give you a schedule of some other meetings. She said, go to the meeting. That's what she said. We hang up. I look at my very busy calendar. I don't have a power lunch that day. I'm in all of those organizations. They probably want me to go over there and make some kind of donation. But, you know, I guess I'll go do an hour. She said, go to that meeting. So I must be able to give them a little hour of my time, although I'm very busy. So I go over there to the Monday Midday Downtown Al-Anon Family Group. And that's still my home group. What a wonderful group of people. We have discovered our literature together. It was a new group. We have discovered healing and wellness in our lives. But I'm getting ready to go into my first Al-Anon meeting, and I want to tell you who the woman was that stood on the outside door with her hand on the doorknob. I was very, very efficient, very organized. You might have said that I looked brittle, but I was so, so very clear on managing things. I am running a household that looks like a military camp. My oldest daughter, who's in high school, she's beginning her journey into drugs and alcohol. So some strange things are happening as far as she's concerned. But, you know, never mind that I would do bizarre things. Never mind that she stayed out late. But when I opened up my drawer and found out she'd gotten the last pair of new pantyhose, I'd go ballistic. I mean, it was so unrelated to the things that I'd get upset about, not the fact that she'd crawled in the window at 2 o'clock, but the fact that she'd taken the last pair of pantyhose. This is the way the household was going. My young daughter, who was 8 years old, had developed what they call precocious puberty, which meant her 8-year-old body had turned into that of a teenager. And she's in the third grade still playing on the playground, and we're having to deal with some of the changes that were happening with her hormones. She's just so confused, and I'm having to take her to the doctor all the time. And I was really so unavailable to her during this very, very scary time of her life. And my husband was bottoming out on his drugs and alcohol and some other things that he was doing that the business on his part was pretty shaky because he wasn't able to take care of it. He had other interests. And Mom and the office president, I'm the one in charge, and I have no spiritual connect. I have no guidance. Plus, I'm in early menopause. You think our house wasn't a war zone? It was a war zone. We had separate rooms, separate TVs. We did not have eye contact in the hallway. It wasn't safe. We did not share meetings. We did not share conversation. It was a harsh, harsh environment in a very, very sophisticated place. And I look back on those days, and I realized that I had an assignment, and it was an assignment that I was trying to do to the very, very best of my ability every single day. And that assignment that I took on was I was trying to please the disease. And you can't. The disease wants more. It is so greedy. It just grabs and grabs and grabs. So I've got my hand on the door, and I opened it up, and I said, "What's that noise?" And you said, "That's laughter. Come on in." It had been a long time since I'd heard that wonderful belly gut laughter that we share in meetings. Oh, my goodness. You welcomed me in. You let me do what I see newcomers do still today. I've learned to call them. I would sit there and I would sing the hymns. You know the ones, "Him did this and him did that." And you would let me sing those hymns, and you let me stay. And you gave me comfort, and you gave me eye contact. And you gave me directions. You said, get a sponsor and work the steps. And that's how I've spent the rest of my time in Al-Anon. I have a sponsor and I work the steps. And basically three incredible things have happened because of that. And I think they all could be labeled as understandings. Because I worked the steps, I got a God of my understanding. I got a me of my understanding. And I got a you of my understanding. To explain a little bit more, the God of my understanding that I brought into the rooms of Al-Anon could best be described like a referee at a sporting event. I'm doing life and a whistle would blow and bam, I'm going to get penalized some way. That's the God I brought into you. And the God that you have given me is the God that's described in the tradition, loving God. That's the God that I have today. Now, I didn't get this God right away. I struggled with it. But I got one of my best insights to this God by reading a bumper sticker. It wasn't one of those bumper stickers like Easy Does It or One Day at a Time. I love those because you can have like a little meeting going down the interstate. It wasn't. It was for a dog obedience school. Now, I'm struggling in early Al-Anon. I'm struggling trying to find this God deal. And I see this bumper sticker, and in tiny letters it said something like, Jones Dog Obedience School. And in large letters it said, Sit Happens. Sit happens, okay? And I realized that I could sit. I could sit out in the backyard under the trees. I could sit at the lake. I could sit at a meeting beside you. And the presence of God that had always been there would be right there beside me. And so I started getting this friendly God. I saw it in your faces. I heard it in your stories. I started having a trust that I'd never had about this God. And this is the kind of God that I needed to hold my hand to take me into that dark cave of steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. Now, my disease is also one of amnesia. I forget that I've got this friendly God and this is what you've taught me. So to help me remember that, I go back to an old TV commercial. It was for V8 juice, and most of you may not have seen it, but it went like this. The people are running around very, very busy. They just don't have time to even have lunch. And they realize this, so they pull out a can of V8 juice and they drink it and they go, oh, I could have had a V8. So when I'm running around and in that place that I call, sometimes I have spiritual flat tires. When I'm in one of those places and I'm running around, I go, oh, I could have had an HP. Higher power. And on Monday when I go into my group and this is red and flat, they know where I'm coming from, you know. So now I have to remember, I've got a loving God. And this is the God that I had to have so I could learn about myself. The me of my understanding that I brought into you was, who do you want me to be? As I'm jumping through another loop, do you want me to be a perfect wife, a perfect mom, a perfect employer, a perfect employee, a perfect PTA member? You want me to cook 115 cupcakes by 7:30 in the morning? No problem. Whatever you wanted me to do, I could do it. And I'm wearing hats so fast and so many, I could not tell you who I am. I could not tell you what I like to do because I didn't even have my own time. Because it was always, I had assignments, responsibilities, agendas, schedules, and all of that, I got lost. So by going through steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, I got the me of my understanding. An incredible me, actually. I actually like myself today, which is a bold statement for me. When I got into steps 4 and 5, remember I was this woman that had been married and divorced. That second marriage, after 8 years and about a year and a half, 2 years in recovery, it wasn't meant to be either. It wasn't wrong for me to want some things in a marriage relationship. I think it was wrong for me to ask or demand them from a man that wasn't available to give them. So we got a divorce, and it was almost like a business divorce. It went on for a long time, and it wasn't especially pretty. But so the me is, I'm married young, divorced, wanted to make up for lost time, got divorced again, making up for some lost time. I, I'll just put it this way. My sponsor did not doze off during my fifth step. I was a feisty woman. You know, I was the drummer in the band. I'd been out there. And I think that what I got out of that was that is not who I am. Because if that was if that were me, I would still be doing those things. So when I'm doing that fifth step, that means I've let go of doing some of that behavior. The one thing I got in touch with about myself is that I had a lot of grieving to do. When you have losses, when you lose to the disease, you have to grieve. Anytime you have a loss, you have to grieve. I'm talking about maybe my parents not being so available to me. I'm talking about missing my daughters growing up. And I'm talking about the biggest loss of all was possibly grieving the loss of the dreams. I really thought we were going to live happily ever after. So when I got in touch with that grieving and that core grieving, I really got in touch with some of this down here and that I could start putting in really, really good stuff, the things that you were teaching me now. I think grieving is a tremendous part of our recovery because we do have losses. We experience losses. My character defects, there's a reading in our literature that says, I was afraid to give up my character defects because they were so a part of me, and I was afraid I'd end up looking like Swiss cheese, you know, that I'd end up with all these holes in me. Well, what I know about my character defects after working these steps and with a sponsor and prayer and meditation about them, you know, we talk about this committee in our head. We said earlier, we've got a friend that says his head is a home entertainment center. It's got everything it needs but an off switch. Well, this was those character defects up there talking to me in my head. That's my committee. They're going on jealousy, envy, procrastination, perfectionism. I mean, they're up there giving it to me all the time. And I finally said, I hear you all. I stomped my foot and I said, line up. I'll talk to you one at a time. That's what I know are my character defects, that they're just chattering at me all the time. And I had to replace that chatter with your slogans and your voices and your kindness and in your positive self-talk. There's a line in our Courage to Change book. It says, being human is not a character defect. That's all I am, just a human. So now that's the me of my understanding that I have today. I can tell you, how I like to spend my time in movies. I like to go to movies. I like to wear blue. I like to feel my hair blow in the wind. I love walking out there on the pier. I can tell you what I like to do today. You know, before, it wasn't safe because if I picked a restaurant and we got bad service, it was somehow my fault. Or if the car got a flat tire, it was somehow my fault. So it was very hard for me to take that first step that I was powerless. Because I got blamed for everything, I thought that also meant that I was also, since I was responsible for that, I was also responsible for making you happy. And I always thought that that was my job before I got into Al-Anon. And so the me of my understanding was just what I was supposed to do to make you happy. Now, to me, the me of my understanding today is me. My name is Linda, and I'm a member of Al-Anon. And for the first time in my life, 59 years old, I am emotionally, physically, spiritually the same age. All of me has finally shown up at the same time. I mean, thank you. I know. That's enough to have a party. So that's who I am. Now the you of my understanding, let me tell you, before I came into Al-Anon, I divided everybody in the world into two categories. If you were female, you were after my husband. And if you were male, you were after me. And that's the way I divided up the whole world before I got into Al-Anon. And I can tell you, since I've been hanging around, I can tell you who you are. And you are absolutely incredible. And I go back to our first step. There's that number one, and there's the word we. It looks like we're in first place. They say stick with the winners. Looks like we are. It says it right there in the steps, we. And also what I know about you comes from that wonderful word, restore. I love that word in our steps. And what I know about restore, nothing is worthy of restoration unless it started out as something of value that got damaged. Think about it. Sometimes you find an old piece of furniture And you have to do some pretty harsh cleaning up on it. Maybe use a heavy brush or cloth and some pretty harsh chemicals. Really get in there and work at it. But when you finish it and you restore it, it is a wonderful thing of beauty, and the wood is golden and seasoned and worthy of this restoration. And sometimes you have a painting, and you restore it, and you have a tiny, tiny brush, and you have to do it so gently and so delicately, but it's worthy of restoring no matter how long it takes, because it was a treasure. And that's who you are. You were the treasures. We were the treasures that got dented, bruised, and wounded. And we are worthy of restoration. We are worthy of recovery. And that's who you are. And I found out how incredible you are by working the rest of these steps. My sponsor was so good. She said, she was funny too, and she knew me. And she was very poetic. She'd say things like this. You have a tendency to pick at scabs. You're not going to make amends and have to make amends on the way you made amends. Pretty clear. Pretty clear. See, I always thought that that volume was the voice of reason. If I could tell it one more time, a little bit louder, maybe he would get it that time. So she took me through the steps, and I made my formal list of the people that I needed to make amends to. And she gave me a little note card, and it had about three sentences on it. And when I would go make those formal amends to parents, to co-workers, to people from my childhood, to friends, to family, no matter who it was, I could say what was on that card, and no matter what they did or what they said, I could not say anything else. I could start over, and I could say those three sentences again, but that's all I could say. Because she said, you're not trying to change their mind. You're not trying to engage. The amends are for you. Oh, the making amends are for me. And I did it very, very properly, I guess is the only word I could come up with. She kept me very, very clean on this. And I made amends to all the people, and they were very successful. Healing happened with my family. But there was a woman on this list. It was a woman that I had met in early Al-Anon, and actually it was a woman who told the truth in a meeting. She said something about infidelity, and quite honestly, I wasn't ready to hear it. So after that, I gossiped about this woman. I criticized her behind her back. I would tell my buddies, oh, we'd meet, and then we'd go into smaller rooms. I'd say, if she goes into that room, let's go into this room. I mean, I really did some disservice to this woman. And she showed up on my amends list. And I tell this story because I believe God wants us to do this work. So I have a very nice deck in the back of my house. And on nice days, it's my practice to go out on my back deck with my coffee and with my books. And it's a very pleasant activity. But one morning, I'm on my front porch, sitting on the steps that look out into the street. And I still have on my nightgown. And I've got my little book there. And I'm kind of reading and praying. And I'm saying, God, I've been doing these steps. I've been making these amends. I can't find this woman. I don't see her anymore. I don't know her last name. Nobody remembers her like I do, but I think I'm supposed to do this work. I don't know. I look up, and the woman is walking down my street. I think she's a ghost. I've conjured her up, you know. Now, here's the video. Here's this very perky, petite woman in her matching sweats, just having a good spring day, walking down this street. And here I am on my porch in my nightgown, jump up, hair flying, it's you, it's you. And I go running at her, and she backs up like, okay, what is this all about? And I make the amends to her. And she knew about amends. And she said, I don't even remember that. She says, she didn't even remember any incidences of being uncomfortable or anything. She says, we travel a lot, so I'm not going to as many meetings this town as I used to. But she's kind of looking around and kind of confused. And I said, what's going on? And she says, you know, I live about two blocks over, and I walk almost every day that we're here in town. And I've never walked down this little street before. She said, I'm trying to figure out where I am. So it's just that she was supposed to be there. You know, God wanted me to make amends to her. Now, I was going through the steps several years later, and I got uncomfortable around this amends step again. And I told you that incredible true story, and I thought, what's going on here? And I was given a gift, and the gift was, in prayer, it was given me a nudge or maybe a suggestion that there were some amends that I might need to do that I call good amends. I'm talking about the woman that gave me those socks. I'm talking about the woman in high school that got me off the back row and got me active in high school activities, possibly prevented a teenage suicide because I really was very, very sad, and she got me active. And I made the list of these people, early Al-Anon women, a woman that gave me a job. She had to talk me into taking this job. I said, I can't do that. She's interviewing me, and she says, you show up Monday at 8 o'clock, and you wear a dress, and you come here. I mean, she forced me to take that job. This woman believed in me when I didn't believe in myself. And I put her on that list. And what I did, I went back to these people, and I said, thank you. I never told you how important you were. See, I was too wrapped up in the disease to acknowledge anybody else. And I just tracked them down and I said, thank you. You were very, very important to me. For what it's worth, it's a wonderful thing to make those good amends. I got balance in Al-Anon. I stopped working so hard. I'm divorced. Healing's happened with my family. I'm single and I'm sad and I'm lonely. And on my knees one time, I asked God, I didn't ask God for anything. I just said, God, I need you to know I'm lonely. Now, I had a daughter still at home, a dog, a rabbit, a cat, and a gerbil, and a fish. But I'm saying, God, I'm lonely. Now, I shared that prayer with my girlfriend, and she said, haven't you heard that Scott's divorce is going to be final in a couple of weeks? And I said, Scott's divorce. I didn't even know he's having any trouble. And she said, where have you been? He hasn't even lived in his household for almost 3 years. See, I had known this man for almost as long as I'd been in Al-Anon because my sponsor had encouraged me to go to open AA meetings, never to share, but to learn about the disease of alcoholism and to hear the stories of hope. So I'd seen this man in this room for years, and I always liked what he had to say, and I thought that he must be having the most wonderful household in recovery. And now all of a sudden I found out that he's going to be single. And so I'm going along with this thought. I'm lonely. He's going to be single. I'm lonely. He's going to be single. I'm lonely. And so I'm leaving the meeting one day, and Scott stepped right in front of me, and he said, can I ask? In fact, he stopped me. I'm bolting for the car. And he stopped me, and he said, can I ask you something? I said, well, yes. And he said, have I done something to offend you? And I said, well, no, why do you say that? And he said, because you never have eye contact, you never say hello, you don't hug on us anymore, you don't go to lunch with us afterwards. He said, I just wondered if I'd done something to offend you. And I said, well, I found out you're going to be single and I'm interested. He said, oh, and stepped out of the way, and I ran for the car. I mean, I ran for the car. And this is before we had cell phones, and I had to wait till I got home to call my sponsor. And I said, oh, my goodness, Scott talked to me, and I said this. And why couldn't I have been more clever? And she said, it sounded like you told the truth. I think it'll be okay. So this December, we're going to celebrate 10 years of marriage. Yes. And it's incredible. It's just incredible. We are living happily ever after, you know, not without conflict or some difficulty sometimes. I have aging parents. We have children that are in and out of whatever, you know. You know, I qualify for Al-Anon because my household that I was born into and because of these marriages and divorces of the men and relationships. And I also know that I give birth to alcoholics. The most beautiful words my daughter ever said to me were not, I love you, Mom. The most beautiful words she ever said was, hi, Mom, my name's Jamie, and I'm an alcoholic. Because with those words, there was hope, because I'd heard them in your stories. And before Scott and I got married, I want to just say a little bit about this daughter. She's out of college. She got sober when she was 21. She says when it got legal for her to drink, she stopped. Go figure, you know. But she was living at home in our house. I'm single, and the little daughter's still there. And our household was where the young AAs would come every night and play cards all night long. And they're having a party, but yet they weren't getting up and looking for jobs or anything the next day. My daughter's a college grad, but she's sober, so, you know, I should be really happy about that. And thank goodness we have that little pamphlet of detachment, which I think should read, Let the Adults in Your Life Be Adults. And she came downstairs one day, and I handed her half of the water bill, her part of the phone bill, her part of the electric bill. And she says, Mom, the day you treated me like an adult was the day I believed I could be one. So I think with our adult children, that's how we help them in recovery, by letting them have their journey. And so my wonderful journey has been in this household with this great guy you're going to hear tonight. And in Al-Anon, we don't give advice. I'm going to give you some advice. Fasten your seatbelt. You're in for quite a treat tonight. And the thing about this household, we have an AA telephone line coming in, and we have an Al-Anon telephone line coming into our house. That seems to help a lot. We also have an understanding. We don't call them rules. We call them understandings. And our understanding in our recovery marriage is God is always going to be first. Our program is always going to be second. And each other, we're going to be in third place. And sometimes we're not even in third place, but we acknowledge that. Scott's got a big business deal going up. He's got to concentrate on that. He's got to use all of his energy around that. And my job is just to hold the space and wait for him to come and put me back in third place. This daughter, this incredible daughter who's 15 years sober and her husband is 10 years sober, when she was pregnant with our first twin grandsons, she had to go on bed rest for 4 months. And we gathered as a family and we said, we want to help. What can we do? So this young couple, with the wife being pregnant and the son-in-law changing jobs and moving back to Nashville from Birmingham, moving in with his in-laws, you can imagine what that situation looked like. And we put that daughter in our bedroom, and she stayed on bed rest for 4 months. As a family, we decided we could do everything we could to keep her healthy and those little babies healthy. My youngest daughter, who was in Alateen, she didn't transition into Al-Anon, but she says, you know, Mom, when two of us get together in our family, a meeting breaks out. So that's what our household looks like. And in our marriage, we are able to, we don't work each other's program, okay? I mean, that's all I can say. It doesn't work if you work each other's program. But we are kind of like railroad tracks. And, you know, we're the rails on this railroad track. And if you'll visualize, if you stand right in the middle of a railroad track, it looks like the rails eventually touch. They come to a point. But it's an optical illusion, because if you move down the railroad track, that point gets on down there also. So I think we're the railroad track, and that point is our shared vision. We have a shareness of going to the rocking chair together. We have a shareness of going to meetings together. We have this shareness that we do. And we are able to ask each other two questions, and they're great questions. The first one is, how long has it been since you've been to a meeting? I mean, things get pretty rough if our meetings slack off in our household. And the second question is, would you be willing to talk to your sponsor about that? So those are the ways that we handle recovery in our household. We sponsor a lot of people. We laugh and we travel together. And I want to tell you a little bit about our bedroom. It's not easy for me to talk about this. Remember, I was the woman that slept in the bathtub, and I had used the bedroom inappropriately to reward, control, manipulate, punish. I had used it very inappropriately. But it came time for Scott and I to share a physical exchange, and I wanted to celebrate. The female of my species, I wanted to celebrate love and joy with this man, but I had confusion. I knew what the kitchen was for cooking. I knew what the living room was for, watching TV, but this bedroom, some things that had happened to me as a young kid that I had to have professional care, some things that sometimes happen in alcoholics' home. So I just had a difficult time with the bedroom. And no matter how much work I'd done, no matter how much support I'd gotten, sometimes some of those old ghosts would show up. So I was given a very gentle, what I call a bedroom prayer. So before Scott and I are going to have a physical exchange, I simply pray, God, help me stay in the moment. That's all. That's the prayer. God, help me stay in the moment. And what that does, it eliminates that old history, that baggage of that I used to carry in. It also, I jokingly say, it eliminates my curiosity about Scott's history too, you know. And it eliminates that uneasiness about the next morning. Was it really okay, or whatever we say, or is Scott going to notice that I gain weight? So that's what I know about the bedroom, is if you say that prayer, then Mother Nature will take care of the rest, okay? I share that as a bedroom prayer. I had an awakening as a result of working these steps, and it's that I have choices. I didn't know that I had choices before I got into Al-Anon. I didn't know I could say yes. I didn't know I could say no. But because I do have this amnesia, I want to tell you a story of how I remember that I have choices. I can choose to call my sponsor or go to a meeting. I can choose to read the literature, or I can choose to be a brat and not do any of it. The choice story, it goes like this. Long ago in this village, there was a wise old man, and there was a young boy that wanted to trip him up. And the plan was this. The boy was going to catch a baby bird, and he was going to call everybody in the village around to embarrass the old man, and he was going to ask the old man if the bird was dead or alive. And if the old man said, "Well, son, that bird is alive," well, the boy was going to crush the baby bird behind his back and show the old man the dead bird. Or if the old man said, "Well, son, that bird is dead," well, then the boy was just going to show the old man the live bird. Great plan. They call the whole village around. The young boy catches the baby bird. He puts it behind his back, and he says, "Okay, old man, you're so all-knowing. You tell me whether or not this bird is dead or alive." And the old man said, "Son, the choice is yours." So I have choice. And I am so grateful that I had choice when I said yes to come and hang out with you on this beach. Thank you, and God bless. Safe travel. Thank you.